First, his war secretary warned against wokeism and fat generals. Then Donald Trump told hundreds of top brass summoned for an unprecedented gathering of U.S. military commanders to expect more deployments to fight the, quote, enemy from within. Although his bragging about federal troops sent to cities run by radical Democrats came in a rambling one-hour-plus speech that also railed against the press, affirmative action, and included praise for firemen and Barack Obama's way of going down staircases without holding the handrail. We'll ask about the commander-in-chief's intentions and that of Pete Hegseth, the former Fox News host who served as a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan and who declared war on beards, woke culture, anonymous whistleblowers, and women and unfit servicemen who can't meet physical training standards. So, how should armies evolve? What's the role of the military, particularly when you're the world's biggest superpower, one that's never seen a coup in its 249 years of existence? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking, what is Trump's plan for the army? With us from Washington, former CIA analyst Patrick Eddington, senior fellow at the Cato Institute think tank, the author of The Triumph of Fear, Domestic Surveillance and Political Repression from McKinley through Eisenhower. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Also from the United States, Carrie Lee, senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund think tank's Strategic Democracy Initiatives. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Philip Golub is professor of political science at the American University of Power, the author of Power, Profit, and a Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion. How are you?
Greetings.
Our former Washington correspondent, France 24 International Affairs editor, Ketevan Gorgeous-Dani, with us as well. How are things? You can, by the way, always listen. That's right. Listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah. Hundreds of top brass in active service summoned from around the world to a military base just outside of Washington, D.C. Often it sounded like a campaign stump speech. The president switching to his prepared remarks to announce upcoming reforms aimed at streamlining acquisitions and expediting foreign sales of military equipment. Before that, well, Donald Trump rude his opponents at home.
We're under invasion from within. No different than a foreign enemy, but more difficult in many ways because they don't wear uniforms. At least when they're wearing a uniform, you can take them out. These people don't have uniforms. But we are under invasion from within. We're stopping it very quickly. Washington, D.C. went from our most unsafe city to just about our safest city in a period of a month. We had it under control in 12 days, but give us another 15, 16 days. It's perfect.
Carrie Lee, let me begin with you. Is there the feeling, do some people actually feel that the United States is under invasion and that it was right to deploy federal troops to cities like Washington?
So public opinion polling inside the United States is pretty split on the president's use of the National Guard in American cities. A majority of the American public thinks that the president has gone much too far with his deployment, but there are still some percentage, probably something around 30 to 40% of the American public who believes that this is the right thing to do. They have had a lot of priming and discussion by the president about the state of American cities for the last, I would say, decade. And so the sense of urgency amongst certain portions of the public is quite high. There's also, in American civil life, lots of concern about crime generally. And it's a popular talking point for politicians. So using the military to combat crime.
And how about the commanders in the room? Is this what they signed up for? How do they feel about this message?
Absolutely not. The American military and most military leaders buy in wholeheartedly to the idea that the U.S. Army fights and wins the nation's wars abroad. And so policing Americans is not something that folks join the United States military to do. It is not something that they join the National Guard to do. To the degree that folks join the National Guard to try and work domestically, it is because they want to do disaster relief and they want to help their communities. Most folks, the vast majority of American service members, are fundamentally uninterested in policing their fellow Americans.
The latest deployment of federal troops to Chicago and late last week to Portland, Oregon, which Trump claimed was under siege from Antifa and other, as he put it, domestic terrorists. So it's a quote from a Truth Social post of his. Portland, one of many cities where there have been growing protests against these masked ICE immigration police rounding up for deportation suspected undocumented foreigners.
There is no insurrection, there is no threat to national security, and there is no need for military troops in our major city.
All right, that's the view of the Democratic governor of Oregon. Patrick Eddington, this concept of the enemy within, how far will Donald Trump go with that?
Well, I will tell you, as a former commissioned officer in the United States Army, this president is a disgrace. His so-called Secretary of War is a disgrace. They have done nothing but try to stoke internal division and fear in this country since his return to power in January. You know, I've lived in the Washington, D.C. metro area for almost 40 years now, and I can tell you that long before Donald Trump wanted to send troops to D.C., the crime rate had been coming down consistently for several years. And just to give you one data point, when I moved out here to work for the Central Intelligence Agency in 1988, there were almost 400 murders in the District of Columbia that year. Within 3 years, there had been nearly 500. And that was at the height of the crack cocaine epidemic back in that particular period. In the days just before Donald Trump used essentially what amounts to a pretext to call up the DC National Guard and bring in elements of the Mississippi and South Carolina and other National Guards to DC. The number of homicides in the district was at less than 100. That was around mid-August. So the notion that, you know, Washington, DC was some kind of war zone or hellscape or any kind of nonsense like that was just as much of a lie, and I use that term advisedly, a lie, as it was about Los Angeles, as it is about Boston, as it is about Portland. So this is completely pretextual. And with respect to this absolutely insane conclave that Mr. Trump and Mr. Hegseth held at Quantico, Virginia, just not that far from Washington, D.C., nothing like that has ever happened in my career. And the fact that the President of the United States is attempting to de facto coerce the American military into being a domestic police force and into terrorizing our fellow citizens. I will be blunt with you. If he continues on this path, there's almost no question in my mind it will lead to civil war.
Civil war. You agree with that, Philip Golub?
Well, I mean, this is Banana Republic kind of stuff. I mean, this doesn't usually happen, this kind of...
Is it Banana Republic stuff, or is it kind of infotainment for the for a president who knows that he can, if he keeps the news cycle...
No. Well, I mean, it's there is that dimension to the way in which Trump does things. But yeah, there's been a concerted, very, very organized effort by the Trump administration from the very start, not only by Trump, but people around Trump to... In effect, establish an authoritarian state from on top by dismantling the administrative state, by dismantling the countervailing powers of the legislature and the judiciary, by engaging in efforts of this kind, which actually break with, you know, 70 years of tradition of military-civilian relations. So what you're seeing here, I say Banana Republic, it's an attempt to establish uncontrolled and undiminished executive power, such that Trump, in this particular case,
just to be clear, is this a thought out strategy?
Yes, it is. If you look at the people in the administration who actually worked on Project 2025, it's quite clearly stated the unitary executive theory. Okay, which is kind of, used to be a marginal theory, judicial theory. The unitary executive theory has been was theorized over decades now and is now being implemented. It was theorized by far-right elements within the judicial circles, and is now being implemented. It was in part implemented under George W. Bush under his administration after 9/11, but it is now being implemented on a full scale. And the main theorist of this is, of course, the head of the administration, the current administration of the budget. Yeah.
Now, Ketevan, you were our correspondent in Washington at the time of the January 6th riots. So you've seen a different Donald Trump administration, but one where there was already some radical thought inside of the Oval Office. How does this day compare after you've seen those generals?
I think the main difference with the first term is that during the first term, Donald Trump was pretty alone when it comes to his entourage in thinking the way he thought. And the people who were there and who were not career people were not prepared for Donald Trump to win. This time, they had 4 years to prepare, and they prepared very well, and they knew exactly what they were doing. You mentioned Project 2025. That was a very clear and clean sort of guideline to what to do. And you have people now around Donald Trump. They're no longer even the generals who, when Donald Trump in his first term was like, well, maybe we could bomb some, the Mexicans or bomb some other country. And they were like, whoa, 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 you need to calm down. There were people who curtailed those thoughts in Donald Trump. Today, you only have people who, at the very best, are simply saying yes. At the worst, are actually giving him these ideas. There are people who are telling him, this is where we go next. This is how we do it. And when you listen to his speech, and there are not a lot of policy elements in his speech, because it was really all over the place, and I've listened to a lot of Donald Trump speeches. This one was top five of the weird speeches. The focus on policy was a clear pivot for the U.S. military under Donald Trump. The goal now is we divert from battling the enemies from abroad and we focus on the enemies from within. And the enemies from within, in a way, are under three categories that worked well during the campaign. There's the war on drugs, the cartels, you shoot down or shoot out boats in the Caribbean Sea. You have immigration, you use the military to shut down the border, and you have security in U.S. cities, and that's where you deploy the military.
Or rather, insecurity, because it's actually generating insecurity.
Just to finish on this point, Carrie Lee, you've heard the rest of the panel. Are these the grievances of a man who's of the man in the White House who craves recognition and ratings, or? Again, as Ketevan and Philip were describing, is this all part of the plan?
Why not both? I really think that even if Donald Trump has an instinct for how to manipulate organizations, I do not think that his plan with regards to the military is particularly well thought out. I do think his advisors have thought an awful lot about it. And I do think that even if he's doing things for ratings, even if he and Hegseth are doing things from a public relations standpoint, these kinds of lawful but awful orders have profoundly corrosive effects on the professional officer corps, profoundly corrosive effects on the ethics of senior military officers, and it leads to really problematic actions going forward and a real slippery slope when it comes to potentially policing and abusing American citizens. So I don't necessarily think that it has to be either or. I think Trump himself can be accidentally tripping into this. His advisors have thought a lot about it. And And it's going to have very, very bad effects on the senior officer corps over time. We're only 8 months in, and already the United States military is striking Venezuelan boats without legal justification, and essentially saying, in front of the entire senior military leadership, we do not care about the laws of armed conflict. We do not care about the Posse Comitatus Act that prevents the military from being used for domestic policing in the United States. And we do not care about human dignity, either in basic training or in training generally in the United States or in combat.
Yeah, there was the U.S. War Secretary, as he's now called, Pete Hegseth, doubling down on what he called woke garbage. Let's take a listen.
This administration has done a great deal from day one to remove the social justice, politically correct, and toxic ideological garbage that had infected our department, to rip out the politics. No more identity months, DEI offices, dudes in dresses. No more climate change worship. No more division, distraction, or gender delusions. No more debris. As I've said before, and will say again, we are done with that.
Done with that stuff. Patrick Eddington, when you listen to Pete Hegseth, is this a warning to the top brass there, or is he just talking over their heads to the general public that's watching?
Well, I don't think there's any question that this is absolutely an attempt to try to at least verbally coerce senior officers into going along with this insanity. You know, it's really fascinating to me and horrifying, quite frankly, to see someone as singularly unqualified as Hegseth be essentially the head of the American military at this particular point in time. Mm-hmm. And I think back, you know, to some of the other men that have held, you know, senior positions, you know, in the department. And it's just amazing to me. You know, I wasn't always a fan of the late Colin Powell, but he comported himself with incredible dignity and grace. And he was a consummate professional. We will never be able to say that about Mr. Hegseth. Not ever, you know, quite frankly.
You won't be able to say it, but what percentage of the people in that room will?
You know, look, it would be a mistake not to assume that a lot of folks in American law enforcement and the military, particularly at the enlisted, you know, and non-commissioned officer or NCO level, it would be a mistake not to understand that a lot of those folks essentially come from a relatively politically conservative background. That being said, there is generally a high level of respect for the chain of command and following orders. And at the end of the day, the troops themselves are going to be taking their cues from the senior leadership. And if the senior leadership remains loyal to the Constitutional Republic, then I would certainly expect to see Hegseth begin to try to take individual senior flag rank officers, generals and admirals who remain loyal to the Constitutional Republic instead of this cult and try to remove them. There's already been some of that. We've seen on the civilian side over at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And again, I'm no fan of the institution, but the reality is shaving off the entire top, essentially, of the Department of Justice's leadership and then reaching all the way down to the special agent in charge level at FBI field offices around the country. That hasn't happened in the history, in the nearly 100-year history, actually, of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And it is a level of politicization that we have never seen before. But I want to go back to something I said previously because I sincerely mean it. I don't think folks really understand just exactly how much rage there is among those of us who are loyal to the Constitutional Republic and have absolutely no intention of going along with this kind of insanity. If they try to move against, I'll just give you one example. I'm a big admirer of Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois. And I'll say, you know, I'm not a political partisan. I have no political party affiliation. But Governor Pritzker of Illinois has really been a major leader in pushing back on a lot of this insanity that's been coming out of Washington in this particular regime. And it will be interesting to watch how he and Governor Newsom of California, they're really kind of the two major leaders, I think, in the Democratic Party right now, how they're going to respond to a lot of this stuff. Because as you've noted already, as we've already heard some of the other folks on the panel talk about, We have seen Trump already deploy out-of-state or red-state National Guard to blue cities or blue municipalities around this country. And if Governor Pritzker's prediction that this is simply a training exercise to prepare for trying to use American troops for so-called election integrity operations next year, we could really see this powder keg explode.
Ketevan Gorgeous-Dani, a plan, this could sound to our viewers like a little bit of a conspiracy theory, a plan to undermine the midterm elections in the United States?
Look, I think, I don't know if there is a plan, but the fact is that all of these little movements of 200 National Guards here, 200 National Guards there, I'm going to deploy troops here, it just gets the American population used to having people in uniform patrolling their streets. It gets people used to having them on the streets. And if you decide that you're going to do something, people will already be used to it. It will no longer be a shock to see them patrolling on the street. And I just want to go back on something that Patrick said about whether or not, you know, Pete Hegseth could go after some of the top brass. He said it in his speech, his words: "If the words I'm speaking today make your heart sink, then you should do the right thing and resign." He's telling the military leaders in front of him that if they disagree with him and what he has just said, they need to go. And he added to that that there had been, he acknowledged, there had been firings at the top. And he said, yes, we cannot change the culture of a department without changing the people. And he said, more leadership changes are coming soon. He's not hiding it. It's not a question of if he's going to do it. It's a question of when and how big that sort of cleanup of the top brass is going to be.
Yeah, this question of loyalty versus loyalty to the chief and commander-in-chief versus loyalty to the Constitution. At the United States Military Academy at West Point, there's something called Constitution Corner. These are images from 2022. And then Fox News host Pete Hegseth is at Constitution Corner. There lie bronze plaques that remind officers and soldiers of their oath of loyalty to that Constitution and to the law. I'm going to put it to you, Carrie Lee, first, because you mentioned how this deployment of troops, in your view, breaks the law in the United States. At what point, what do soldiers have to do to uphold that loyalty to the Constitution? At some point, it's disobedience to an order, is it not?
So I spent almost 10 years teaching senior military officers, lieutenant colonels and colonels in professional military education at both the U.S. Air War College and most recently at the U.S. Army War College. I have two thoughts about this. The first is that most senior military officers, even at senior ranks, have not thought deeply about what it means to swear an oath to the Constitution. To most military officers, an oath to the Constitution means civilian control of the military, which means obeying orders. That's about as deeply as most officers have thought about this principle, because they have been busy doing other things. It is important right now that senior officers in the United States military are thinking about their oath to the Constitution, which is in fact an oath to the Republic. It is an oath to a form of government, as opposed to a single leader. And this is going to be very important because at times, right, when you have a leader who is giving orders, a legitimately elected leader like Donald Trump, giving orders that nevertheless undermine constitutional principles and undermine the form of government, this puts senior military officers in an incredibly difficult position, for which we have literally no precedent. So that's the first point. Relatedly, when you have this kind of tension, and if you do have a leader issuing potentially unconstitutional orders, there isn't actually a lot of protection for senior officers who are inclined to disobey or question. The bar for not obeying orders is quote, patently unlawful. So the bias is towards compliance. Right. Patently unlawful means any reasonable person would understand, because you can't have a staff sergeant in the missile silo questioning whether the president has the constitutional authority to launch nuclear weapons. Like, that system has to work. And so the bar is so high for disobeying orders that it's really up to, you know, retired general officers, civil society, Congress, other forms of checks and balances on executive power to step up, because senior military leaders are largely they are kind of working without a net here.
Philip Golub.
Well, I mean, if you look at it from the standpoint of the, you know, the Constitution itself, if you look at the administration's behavior over the past months, it's been a short period of time that they've been in power, that Trump has been in power. The Trump administration, not only Trump himself, have been systematically attempting to reconfigure the constitutional system itself. Look at birthright citizenship. The demand by Trump and his administration to end something that's been engraved in the Constitution since the 14th Amendment. Birthright citizenship is one of the more fundamental characteristics of American democratic citizenship. Yes, citizenship means the right to have rights. So the right to have rights. And what they're doing is they're systematically undermining those parts of the Constitution that don't fit their authoritarian agenda.
And you heard Carrie Lee saying that the pushback, she doesn't expect it to come from the military.
Right. Well, it's not going to come from the military, because there's this long history of since the United States military became this very vast force after the Second World War. There's civilian military relations have been characterized by military obedience to civilian leadership. So you're not going to see overt pushback. You're going to see individual people coming out, leaking information, doing things of this type. Just like you'll find people in the Central Intelligence Agency and the intelligence agencies rebelling against what is happening, but in more covert ways rather than overt ways. You can't expect it to come from there. It has to come from politics. It's the political resistance that actually counts here. What's quite astonishing about all of this, this attempt to reorient the American military to domestic political purposes, not to police, because it has nothing to do with policing. It has to do with taking over the country. Yes, ideologically and otherwise, physically. Yeah. Now, what's extraordinary about this is that this is fundamentally going to weaken not only the ethos, but actually the practical ways in which the military work. In other words, nobody's going to feel safe anymore within the military who has any kind of dissent over these totally irrational kinds of wars. And this is something which is also more fundamental. Trump seems to be pulling back from, contrary to what many people thought, contrary to what I thought actually initially, pulling back from international commitments, military commitments, security commitments, seems to be pulling back, including from East Asia, where everyone expected, including myself, that there would be this an intensified military security competition with China. That's not what we're seeing now. We're seeing a kind of pullback to a form of continentalism, hemispheric security, hemispheric hegemony, and the domestic uses of the American military. And we have to think about that. He thinks he wants control, it seems to me, it's my interpretation, control of the Western Hemisphere, absolute power in the United States, and to let other parts of the world more or less deal with themselves. Europe has to deal with Ukraine. Israel will deal with the Middle East, not only Gaza, but with the whole of the Middle East. China can have the South China Sea, and Taiwan, and so on and so forth. It's not even spheres of influence. Mm-hmm. U.S. pullback from its globalized commitments of the past. It seems to me there's a pattern there, and the deployment of the U.S. military domestically is part of that, as part of a domestic authoritarian agenda.
We talk about ideology, but there's actually more than one at play here. A form of isolationism in what you describe, a pulling back, you call it. But Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, well, he's drawn attention to his qualifications and beliefs, beliefs that he appears to wear on his sleeve, most notably with a tattoo that says kafir on his arm, which means infidel in Arabic. And he has crusader symbols as well on his chest. That's not exactly isolationist in its thought. Patrick Eddington, there are people who
how many people who voted for Donald Trump go along with this sort of civilizational clash kind of view of the world?
You know, I would say that Mr. Trump's baseline political support probably is in the 20-25% range of actual, you know, active voters, whether you want to, you know, try to slice it with registered voters or likely voters. What I think is really interesting that we're seeing now, you know, Sarah Longwell of Longwell Partners, and more famously, I think, of the Bulwark, has been doing a lot of focus group work over the last several months, kind of looking at where voters who originally went for Joe Biden in 2020 and went for Trump in 2024 are now almost universally expressing buyer's remorse, if you will, for the choice that they've made. And that for me is at least one sign of hope, you know, for where this might ultimately end up. But let me just go back to the military discussion here and specifically the history of the United States. I'd have to take a little bit of an exception to something that Kerry said, and that is this. This is not unprecedented. You know, 2 years before the Civil War broke out, a Union officer by the name of Robert E. Lee led troops against John Brown at Harper's Ferry. And then it was 2 years later that Robert E. Lee made the fateful decision to stand by Virginia and the institution of slavery instead of taking Abraham Lincoln's offer to lead the Union Army. So I think we do have to be careful here in terms of prognosticating about just exactly where this is going to go, because we're in extremely uncharted waters here. And I think it would be premature to reach any kind of judgment about exactly, you know, how many American military officers, particularly at the senior level. And I will tell you that I worked at the Pentagon, you know, with the Joint Staff, you know, doing a lot of direct support for the unified and specified commands. And at least back then, you would find a fair amount of what I would describe as subtle, you know, political differences between a lot of the senior commanders. But those commanders that I personally dealt with, I know they understood their oath was to the Constitution, and not simply to, you know, some kind of, you know, formulaic approach to this. I think they all understood the difference between lawful and unlawful orders. And a lot of folks are going to, I think, potentially be facing a lot of very difficult decisions in the days, weeks, and months ahead in terms of what they're going to have to personally decide to do if they get an order, for example, you know, to fire on American protesters, especially if those protesters are unarmed, as they almost invariably are. So I'm very fearful for where this country is going and what it means. I'm not alone in that respect, but I still maintain hope. I maintain the belief that there are enough Americans in this country who are beginning to turn against this regime, and that as time goes on, it will become more and more difficult for the regime to try to carry out some of these more radical plans and ideas, such as those that Mr. Trump and Mr. Hegseth articulated today at Quantico.
Carrie Lee, you heard there Patrick referencing past times when there were fateful decisions that had to be made by officers. And there have been times where there's been tension over the role of the military on U.S. soil, the most recent being in the U.S. during the Vietnam War, when the National Guard used lethal weapon in Ohio and Mississippi. Will it come to that?
So I think it's really important to understand that the discussions that happened prior to the Civil War were really pre-professional army, and that the National Guard in particular, you know, especially during the Vietnam War, is a very different National Guard than what we have today. Prior to, you know, during the Vietnam War, the National Guard was not operationally capable. It was not professionalized. When they became a part of the total force along with the reserve component, and this is maybe getting into the weeds for some of the, you know, for European viewers, but essentially over the last 50 years, the National Guard and the reserve forces in the United States have professionalized, and they have become a part of the kind of total force military, and then active participants in what some call the War on Terror, what others call the post 9/11 wars, et cetera. And are operationally exceedingly capable. They also have, you know, a lot of professional training. So I want to caveat, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with anything. I don't think Patrick and I really disagree here. There's just different historical contexts for when and how people have thought about their oath. The oath to the Constitution has changed. The addition of the oath, the addition of all enemies, foreign and domestic, was in fact a product of the Civil War. The oath did not include domestic enemies prior to the Civil War. But after after 1865, it was amended. So, you know, the history of U.S. civil military relations has changed. It has adapted. And the forces that we see today, particularly our National Guard forces in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles, in Portland, being threatened to be used in Chicago, heading to Memphis. I mean, the number of cities is astonishing that the president and other governors are willing to dedicate their forces to go police American cities. These are very different forces than what we saw at Kent State, for example, during the Vietnam War. They are far more professional. They are far better trained. And they are very interested in keeping their head down right now, because this is a mission that they are fundamentally uncomfortable with. Morale is very low in the National Guard right now. You've seen kind of mass defections and folks who are just trying to get through this assignment. They don't intend to re-up or re-enlist because it's not what they signed up for.
All right. Better, more professional, better trained. There was this question brought up by the war secretary in that speech, which is the fitness level of the military. Journalist Dexter Filkins wrote a long form piece earlier this year in The New Yorker magazine where he said, according to a Pentagon study, more than three quarters of Americans between the age of 17 and 24 are ineligible because they're overweight, unable to pass the aptitude test, afflicted by physical or mental health issues, or disqualified by such factors as a criminal record. Kedavan Gorgestani, an army, a reflection of the society it's in, there is this issue of fitness in the military.
I think, obviously, if you go in the military, there is some form of fitness that you need to pass. Not everybody can serve. But I think the fact that Pete Hegseth is focusing simply on the fitness is a little bit odd when you think about all the issues and the challenges ahead for the U.S. military, that this would be the first major speech when he calls up all of the admirals and the generals is to tell them, because what he's saying is the soldiers have to pass fitness tests, so do you. Because when he says that we don't want fat generals, he's talking about the top brass, not the combat people. He's talking about the people who are walking around, he said, roaming the halls of the Pentagon. And so he's talking to the people who are sitting right in front of him saying, well, you need to pass the fitness test. There's the fitness test. There is also this idea that you have to go to the highest male standard, because according to him, the fact that their standards for female soldiers is not good for the military as a whole, because you lower the standards to allow women in. He says if the females can meet those male standards, great. If they don't, well, tough luck. You can sit this one out. But I think the focus was not, it was the fitness, then it was the beards, it was the height, it was, you know, the haircut. All of these things were going into, basically, he wants people who look like him to be in the U.S. military, maybe a white man who is pretty fit. But I would just say, because you showed some footage of Pete Hegseth in the past and his tattoos and everything, there's also that video of him going around trying and not really succeeding at doing pull-ups, which for a you know, a soldier is pretty decent to do. And there's been a lot of female soldiers and women who have served in the past who said, well, maybe you want to try the fitness test and do pull-ups like the women do it, not like Pete Hegseth, because he can't do it. But I really think when I was listening to it, I was thinking, this is why you brought in hundreds of generals and admirals, is to basically tell them and lecture them on what they should look like and how fit they should be, which A, could have been a note. This meeting could have been an email, basically. And also, is there nothing else that you want to tell these top military officials? Nothing else on comes to your mind besides the beards and their weight?
Yeah, I mean, totally. It's masculinist, it's sexist, it's also racist. The elimination the elimination of African-American generals and top officers in the first period, it suggests a number of things. Authority, real authority, does not assert itself in this way. Real authority asserts itself quietly. And when you have authority over people, authority over a military establishment in particular, that authority shows itself in the ways in which there is a kind of natural communication and understanding between subalterns and superiors. Here, Hegseth is actually showing, though he doesn't know that, or perhaps he does know that, in fact, he has no authority. He's a minor figure in the military. He has no experience of any kind. He's lecturing people who have hundreds of times more experience than
he. He served 2 tours of duty.
And so what? So what? These generals have served 10, 15, 20. No, he doesn't have any kind of organic or natural authority or politically based authority, because you can also have politically based authority.
So we're running short on time. Patrick Eddington, what should be the qualifications, not just in the United States, but globally, for being a soldier in 2025?
Well, I think that's strictly a matter of each nation's, the political leadership of each nation's decisions about the kinds of standards that they should set. What I will tell you is that Mr. Hegseth's claim that there are a lot of fat generals, I will tell you, I haven't seen that many in my life. And the ones that I, the generals that I have had the opportunity to meet have been some of the finest men that I've ever known. Greg Newbold, there are several others that I've had the privilege of actually spending some time with. So I, you know, again, as a former officer, I find it all just completely insulting. It's ludicrous. I think that the existing physical fitness standards for the American military, and they vary a little bit, you know, by service, and also even within services. I mean, if you're going to be, you know, special forces, you know, whether you're talking about Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, or actually, you know, Delta. Obviously, those requirements are going to be much more stringent because of the nature of the missions that those individuals wind up going on. But, you know, I really, you know, am very much of the same mind as Philip with all of this stuff. You know, Hegseth has, he knows he's not respected, and it shows. I think it really maybe is the simplest way to put it. And We've had some good secretaries of defense, and we've had some that you know, probably shouldn't have had the job. But this is the least qualified human being ever to sit in that position. And you know, I will say for myself, as a former officer, I look forward to his departure.
Carrie Lee, no sitting the fence there. Carrie Lee, again, what I'm going to put the same question to you. What should a soldier look like in the year 2025 and in the context of lots of volatility in the, we talked about the United States, but around the globe?
It really depends on what they're going to be asked to do and what their countries are going to ask them to do. So I'm fortunate in that I'm co-editor of a volume that's coming out early next year on the future of the all-volunteer force in the United States. So I've spent the last couple of years thinking hard about what do we need from soldiers and service members and sailors and Marines and Guardians and all of them. And it varies by service. It varies by mission. It varies by identity. And so there's no one size fits all. And this is where I think the secretary is profoundly mistaken, that there is no one size fits all fitness standard for people in the United States military or militaries globally today. We are so specialized, and we need to be so specialized because the character of war is changing and because the future of combat is changing in ways that we don't totally understand, but will be aided by artificial intelligence, new technologies, and yes, ground combat, as we see in Ukraine. So we're going to need different things from different service members, and to impose a universal, you know, again, one size fits all solution on everyone is really a betrayal of the mission of the military, and it betrays kind of a misunderstanding of what the military needs to do and what the needs of the future are.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Carrie Lee, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank as well Patrick Eddington, Philip Golub, Kedavan Gorgestani. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.